Hello and welcome to Zet Forward, a podcast celebrating authors and other individuals who are involved with projects for the benefit of Seton Hall University and the world around us. My name is Alan DeLosier, University Archivist, and I'm very proud to welcome and introduce our guests for today, Dr. Margaret McGinnis and Dr. Tom Resnick, co-editors of the book, The Cambridge Companion to American Catholicism, published by Cambridge University in 2021. Now, to acquaint the listener with this work, the following summary has been provided by the publisher. This companion provides a comprehensive overview of American Catholicism's historical development and distinctive features. The essays, all specially commissioned for this volume, highlight the inner diversity of American Catholicism and trace the impact of American Catholics on all aspects of society, including education, social welfare, politics, and intellectual life. The volume also addresses topics of contemporary concern, such as gender and sexuality, arts and culture, social activism, and the experiences of the Black, Latinx, Asian American, and cultural Catholic communities. Taken together, the essays in this companion provide context for understanding American Catholicism as it is currently experienced and help to situate present-day developments and debates within their larger trajectory. Now, before we turn over the microphone to our guests, I want to provide a brief biographical sketch on Dr. McGinnis and Dr. Resnick. Margaret McGinnis is professor of religion at LaSalle University. She is the author of Call to Serve, a history of nuns in America, published in 2013, which won the 2014 Catholic Press Association Book Award in History. And she also received the 2016 Distinguished Book Award from the Conference on the History of Women. She is also the author of Neighbors and Missionaries, a history of the Sisters of Our Lady of Christian Doctrine, published in 2012. Thomas Resnick is an associate professor of history at Seton Hall University and co-editor of the quarterly journal American Catholic Studies. He is author of Church and Estate, Religion and Wealth in Industrial Era Philadelphia, published in 2013. Now it is my pleasure to ask both of our guests about their involvement with this project. Okay, Maggie and Tom, what inspired you to serve as editors for this particular book?
Well, I suppose because we were asked, you know, in the end. Cambridge Press has a whole series of companion volumes that have to do with religion, and they cover a wide range of topics. And when kind of the contact person at Cambridge contacted me, I guess two things. The first is I was sort of surprised there wasn't one on Catholicism already. But I also almost immediately said to her, this is not a job for one person, this is a job for two people. And so I said, let me contact Tom Resnick.
Yeah, and it worked out to be a really fine partnership. And one of the reasons that we think that Cambridge reached out to us was because of our past experience as co-editors of American Catholic Studies. When I started working with the journal, Maggie was serving as co-editor, and I then sort of stepped in and succeeded her in that role. And so because of that, they knew that we were familiar with the field broadly, and that we also had connections. So then when it came time to scope out authors for these individual chapters, that we had those connections professionally. And part of the work in putting together the volume was shaping the basic framework for it, that Maggie and I were the ones who were given free rein to plan out the book, to determine which chapters needed to be covered, to provide initial outlines for the volume as a whole, and to give it that sort of structure. And so they needed people who were experienced enough and had a broad perspective.
Sounds good. And actually, you say it's not a job for one, so I'm glad you collaborated, because I've read your work in the past and it's really top rate. I'm just curious about some of the individuals you reached out to collaborate on this work.
Yeah, first, if I may, I would say that part of the, to help readers understand the basic structure of the book, then trying to figure out, well, how do you tell the story of American Catholicism in one volume? We knew that these chapters would only scratch the surface, but they needed some internal structure. So the book has three main parts. The first is a chronological overview, three chapters that deal with the basic chronology of American Catholicism, a chapter on the colonial era, a chapter on the 19th century or the immigrant church, and then a chapter on the Catholic Church in the 20th century, or as it's referred to in American history, the American century. So we're playing off of that for the Catholic century. Then we have a series of thematic chapters that look at topics like Catholic faith and worship, Catholic intellectual life, education, women religious, politics. And then we conclude with chapters that highlight what we called the many faces of Catholicism, that speak to the internal diversity of the American Catholic experience, with chapters that look at lay women, Black Catholics, Hispanic Catholics, Asian American Catholics, and as a first in a volume of this sort, a chapter on cultural Catholics, those who may no longer identify as practicing Catholics, but have certainly been shaped by Catholicism and contribute to American Catholicism in their own ways. So once we had that internal structure in place, then we started doing the work of reaching out to individual authors. And Maggie, I don't know if you wanted to add anything to that.
Well, just that I think we were both very grateful that of the 19 essays, 18 said yes on the initially. One person for one chapter said, you know, I've been the voice of chapters like this for too long, and someone else should do it, which was a really actually a very kind and generous way to look at things. And then of the original 19 contributors, only one had to drop out for personal and family reasons. And so, and again, someone else very graciously stepped in and held to the deadlines. In a way, it's kind of a miracle that the 19 chapters all got in. You know, I mean, I'm not sure that happens all the time. But they all came through in the end. And again, as Tom said earlier, I think between us, we knew almost everybody at least a little, you know. I mean, some people we knew better than others, but and that made it very helpful, I think. And a lot of them knew each other, which helped.
Which also made it easier when you had to go back to somebody and say, hey, this is a great chapter, but hey, that middle section needs a little bit of work.
Right.
Having sort of friendships with these people certainly helped.
Well, that's good. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
I'm sorry. I would just add, it's really hard. Tom mentioned how hard it was to kind of tell the whole story. But in 8,000 words or so per essay, these folks, some of them have written books on their topics, you know, and they were very gracious about the amount of slashing that we did for to be brutally honest about it.
And we were also very fortunate that the book project began before the pandemic struck, and so most of the authors had already completed drafts of their chapters before those sort of days of lockdown, so that they were able to get to libraries and archives and things like that. And so the project was not delayed because of the pandemic.
Right. So true, and of course, there's always room for volume two. But not right away, of course. I need some time to rest.
Not today, right?
Right. And just you know, following up on what Tom said, and also from my own perspective as an archivist, what are some of the best and most unique resources you found in archives, libraries, and other historical avenues that have helped you with your own research with this book, the research projects and texts that came in, and also your own scholarship?
Yeah, I mean, sort of there's been so much. And with the pandemic, I think it's made sort of many of us realize how valuable digitized collections are. We're still historians. We love print. We recognize the value of unique rare materials that are in archives. And, you know, we could not do our work without that. But we're grateful that many more materials have now migrated online, whether it's an individual archive that is digitized in collections, whether it is sort of more universal efforts, so like archive.org that has made many books available as digitized versions to scholars and students alike. And I think particularly things, organizations like the Catholic Research Resources Alliance that has done such a wonderful job linking together archives, promoting the collections that are out there, and spearheading projects like the Catholic News Archive, which now contains sort of years upon years of digitized Catholic newspapers that allow us to find material in such an accessible way, replacing that effort to try and hunt down material by scanning through reams of microfilm. So those sorts of things, it's those sorts of resources that are really transforming scholarship today.
Yes, and I think each individual author had a lot of experience in the archives that they were sort of more directly connected to their area of expertise. And I'm thinking, for instance, of Angie Dries, who did the essay on global Catholicism, who had extensive experience, you know, in Maranol archives and the archives of the Columban Fathers and so on and so forth, you know, missionary congregations. And they were all able to draw on the archives they had used in the past for their own essays, which was helpful because, again, for a lot of this project, the archives were closed and they could get some help from archivists working at home, but not always everything they might have needed.
Now, it's nice to hear about how, you know, even during the time of the pandemic and the quarantines, this work was able to go forward. You know, even you mentioned that beforehand, most of the essays were completed, but just having those final extra touch is very important. Now, with this compilation out there and being, you know, used in more extensive form, how do you think this particular work and also Catholic studies at large will benefit from this particular volume going forward?
Well, yeah, I think when Tom and I started talking about this, I don't think we thought it would necessarily be used in classes, although that's always an added bonus. But Cecilia Moore, who wrote the essay on Black Catholics, is using it this semester and seems pleased with it. And I guess the students seem pleased with it, more to the point. But we really envisioned it as a volume that when someone, a grad student or an upper level undergrad, wanted to start a project, their advisor would say to them, go check out that Cambridge Companion and take a look at that essay on Catholics and politics, or Catholics and the arts, or whatever, and see where that might lead you. You know, see what ideas you might get from it. See what their bibliography says. See if this is what you're thinking about. And hopefully that will happen.
It was very much sort of thinking in terms of helping not just students, but sort of non-specialists. And It was as we were talking about the project, and as we talked to the authors, we advised them that put in this volume what you would expect if you were picking up a volume on the Cambridge Companion to American Judaism or American Mormonism or American Methodism, those things that you are not familiar with. How would you explain it to people who really need that primer on a topic? But one of the other things that was really fascinating about this project is how scholarly, how sort of publication has changed. And so with Cambridge University Press behind the project, this isn't simply a print book, it's also part of the Cambridge Core, their online database of materials that colleges and universities and libraries subscribe to. And so that people, sort of the expectation was that some people may read the book, but others are simply going to be downloading individual chapters. So as the editors and as authors, we had to think about both the integrity of the book as a whole, but also each chapter as a standalone piece.
Right, which meant for a lot of, on our part, that's where some of our work came in, was, you know, someone might say, well, I assumed that someone else was going to say something about this in their essay. And our response would be, well, yes, they are, but we still need two or three sentences from you about it to, you know, for someone reading it as a standalone. And you know what I'd love to see? I'd love to see some parish groups read some individual essays from this, you know, someone looking at Latinx Catholics or a group looking at Black Catholics or whatever. And just because we really did have kind of the interested laity in mind when we were writing it as well as academics.
That's a good point, Maggie. And the beautiful part is not only print version, but the electronic version, as you mentioned. Now, just even on a more current theme, your own classes in terms of teaching Catholic studies, even though the text may not be at this point required reading for every course, which it should be in the future. Sorry, my editorial comment, but it's hopefully we'll catch on more. But Tom makes the great point about, you know, having it available for different class assignments, for reference, for papers and so forth. I just want to find out your current classes or your most current class. How has Catholic Studies been received, especially in this time of quarantine and also contemporary society? And what are you finding in terms of pedagogy, scholarship, and how the students are reacting to what's going on in the Catholic Church?
Oh, that's a great question, because both Maggie and I regularly teach courses on the history of American Catholicism. Mine's sort of here at Seton Hall within the History Department and Catholic Studies. Maggie's coming into it from a Department of Religion and Religious Studies, but in some ways our classes are very similar to one another. And it's always sort of interesting to see what students are themselves interested in. And it's sometimes humbling as a professor that we have our own plans for what they need to know, but then they remind us of the questions that they have. And so certainly in light of the pandemic, there were opportunities to talk about the Catholic Church's role in health and welfare and responding to earlier epidemics and Catholic sisters who were responding to cholera or the flu. But the stuff more recently, questions that over race and racial justice, social activism, but also family history. You know, I think there's a genuine curiosity among the students to sort of learn about the Catholic past because it helps them understand their own family histories. Kind of immigrant grandparents or the world of American Catholicism that their parents grew up in say the 80s and 90s.
I teach often in the fall a first year seminar on Philadelphia Catholicism. And one of the things I ask them to do is to visit a place. And I, you know, Shrine of St. John Newman and the cathedral and St. Rita Kasia, places like that. And the last time I taught it, which was pre-pandemic, it was fall of 2019, a couple of students, when they told, who were from the Philly area, when they told their grandparents where they were going, their grandparents wanted to go with them, which I thought was just fascinating, you know, and their grandparents said, well, you know, I haven't been there since I was a kid, and I'd like to go back to that, to the, you know, Shrine of the Miraculous Medal or whatever. And what was nice about that was it gave them, as Tom said, the question of family. It gave them that little bit of connection, I think, a little more of a connection there.
It's good to have those connections, Maggie. And it's nice to hear about, you know, your embrace of not only the Catholic Church universal history, but also the local history perspective and your ties to Philadelphia. I'm just curious also in terms of, you know, your own research, even beyond this book, in terms of what you're working on now and how your research is progressing, so we can look forward to your next published works in the near future.
Well, I have a manuscript on Catherine Drexel and the Sisters of the Blessed Sacrament that's currently at Paulist Press. So I'm in a bit of a holding pattern at the moment, waiting to see what changes they want, or if they want changes, or how this is going. And one thing I've discovered from talking to other folks is, you know, everything is backed up because of the pandemic. Everything is, you know, presses are also shorthanded. And somebody just told me that her book was delayed a month because there was a shortage of boxes, you know, to ship it. I mean, the supply chain is going in a lot of different directions. So that's where I am. I'm kind of just finished something and waiting for the next phases of that. But I'll turn it over to Tom because he's in the middle of something right now.
Sure. Well, I was going to say, you know, I don't know if there are any sort of, you want to give a spoiler alert, but to tell our listeners a little bit about Catherine Drexel, because we actually have that in common. We've both done some research on her. She was the figure who helped inspire my initial doctoral dissertation, which was a study of religion in Philadelphia. And she, Catherine Drexel, as a Philadelphian, was a central figure to that research. So maybe you can fill people in a little bit on her biography and life story.
Sure. And Tom, I actually found Tom's book very helpful in my research. So a plug for church and estate. Catherine Drexel was at one point, along with her two sisters, the richest women in America. When their father died, he left them, I think by today's standards, around $400 million. I mean, it was a massive amount of money. But he set it up in such a way that it was a trust. He was worried that men would want to marry his daughters for their money, not an entirely unfounded fear, I think. And so the money was actually going to go to any grandchildren that he might have, which he did not have in the end. And Drexel and her sister, her half-sister Louise, chose to use that money to minister to Blacks and Indigenous people in the United States, in a variety of ways, building churches, building schools. Probably her most enduring legacy is Xavier University in New Orleans, which is the only Catholic historic Black college and university. And when Drexel died, the money that was left, and there wasn't much, did not go to the Sisters of the Blessed Sacrament, which was the religious congregation she founded. It went back to the charities that were stipulated in her father's will, because there were no grandchildren. So I'm hoping that the book will kind of encourage some conversations about race, about evangelization, about women religious. You know, once it comes out, I'm hoping it will contribute to the conversations that are taking place in those areas right now.
And on my part, the research that I'm doing also connects with the history of women religious in the United States. I've been currently doing a research project on the history of St. Vincent's Hospital in New York City, which was located in Greenwich Village. And when it was founded in 1849, it was the first Catholic hospital in New York City. And when it closed in 2010, it was the last Catholic hospital in New York City. So I was very much interested in that institutional dynamic and what the history of St. Vincent's Hospital tells us about the history of Catholic healthcare in the United States. But what I've come to realize in the course of that project is just how central the work of the Sisters of Charity was to building up the American healthcare system, you know, and not just the Sisters of Charity of New York, but their sisters across the country, you know, all the women religious of various congregations who were doing similar work. They really helped build up the sort of voluntary healthcare system in the United States and worked to speak on behalf of the poor and the marginalized, both sort of through their ministries, but also in terms of public policy. And so when the history of kind of healthcare in the United States is written, American Catholicism, American sisters need to be part of that story, up in, you know, including things like the work of Sister Carol Keehan, a daughter of charity who was influential in helping to secure the passage of the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, as it's known. Those stories need to be recognized more fully. And doing the research on St. Vincent's Hospital is also a very nice project for me as somebody who teaches at Seton Hall University, since the Sisters of Charity of New York were one of the communities that traces its roots to Elizabeth Ann Seton and the founding of the Sisters of Charity, the first American congregation of women religious in the United States.
Right. Nice tie-in, Tom. And also, it's great, and thank you for sharing, because it's always interesting to hear how historians are progressing on their scholarship and then sharing it with the world in various ways. So I'm looking forward to both your publications in the near future. Also, in terms of going the other side of the coin, how about yourselves in terms of reading, if you have any spare time, so to speak, in terms of what you've been reading recently and yeah, from your local libraries or what have you, in terms of things that are helping you not only with class preparation, but also in terms of what's inspiring you or just of interest, so you can give us some perspective on that end of the reading spectrum.
But one thing, if I may, sort of one book, and it's probably on Maggie's bookshelf as well, but I've just sort of finished reading a book by Maureen O'Connell, who is a professor of religion at LaSalle University, and she wrote a book called Undoing the Knots, and it traces her own family's history over the course of five generations in Philadelphia and the Philadelphia area, and looking at sort of the American Catholic experience and encounters with race and the anti-Blackness that has at the time been written into the Catholic experience. And one of the things that's really remarkable about the book is the way that she is able to trace her own family history, put her own family's experience front and center in the book. But I'm also, as a historian, amazed at the historical research that she did, including going into county historical societies, going into parish research collections, and mining those materials to find the fragments of her own family's past that are recorded. So in some ways, it's a model for other people who want to know about their own family histories, that the material is there, but it often takes a great deal of hunting and searching in order to get those materials. But she recently presented on her book at the American Catholic Historical Society in Philadelphia, which is an organization that both Maggie and I belong to. So it was great to hear her speak on the topic, but also to read her book.
Yes, I'll join that plug for Maureen's book. It's really phenomenal. And it's not something all of us can write, you know, and I think she brings her training as an ethicist into it as well, and kind of blends those two, the kind of history and religious studies and ethics together in a very nice way. But the book that I'm about to start reading, I was just looking over at my pile to get the right title. It's called The Making of American Catholicism. And it's a series of chapters. It's by Michael Pfeiffer, and it's Regional Culture and the Catholic Experience. And so he kind of breaks it in, he looks at place as well as the Catholic experience. And I'm really looking forward to digging into that perhaps later today.
Great. This is good to hear about. What's oh, Tom, did you have something else to say? Or?
No, sort of. I think Maggie and I can both sort of keep going about all of the books that we have plans to read, especially these dreams as summer is approaching. And we're both crazy enough that we consider these academic books beach reading. But I've also been looking at a book by Angel Garcia, The Kingdom Began in Puerto Rico, Neil Connolly's Priesthood in the South Bronx, which is a book that came to my attention as it was reviewed in American Catholic Studies, and I knew that this was something that I needed to read since I went to college at Fordham University in the Bronx, and this was sort of very much part of the story. But it traces the life of this one priest, Neil Connolly, who sort of was a priest in the 1950s and 1960s, was sent to Puerto Rico to learn Spanish so he could better minister to the Puerto Rican community in the Archdiocese of New York. But then it really traces the history of community activism and the role that not just Neil Connolly, but the Catholic Church and Catholic institutions played in responding to the social transformations of the 1970s and the sort of the challenges that urban immigrant communities faced during that time period. And it's very much one thing that I appreciate about the book is that it brings us more closely to the present or the recent past. So the 1970s, 80s, 90s, you know, sort of ways that when you think about studying history, it's always about going far back in the past. And it's reminding us that we now need studies of the 70s and 80s and 90s that may seem like recent memory to people, but it's no different than somebody sort of studying World War II during the 1970s. You know, it's only a 30-year gap there. Same way for us in from our vantage point in 2022, we need to go back to the 80s and 90s, which have that same 30-year gap.
It's so true, Tom. There's a lot of like great scholarship out there, and this is great to hear about these particular volumes. And you're not crazy at all. Beach reading is very important in terms of not only in the office, but just anywhere that it speaks to you. So talking a little bit outside the realm of Catholic scholarship, just say a reader who's not familiar with the church in any form, or even just a little bit, what's one of the common myths that you'd like to debunk concerning discipline and research within this field at large, your book in particular, and your own experiences with non-Catholics?
Well, it's funny because yesterday I was having lunch with a group of people, and there was a, you know, an 11-year-old there who was out of school for the day and who is Jewish, and he wanted to know what a sister was, you know. And it's still I mean, he's 11. It's nothing on him, but it still, I guess, surprises me. Number one, how little people know, and number two, sort of how many want to only talk about negative experiences people have had with Catholicism, either themselves or people they know, or. And it just, the topic is so much more broad than that. It is so much more complex than that. And I just feel, and I hope, kind of bringing it back to the volume, that the volume kind of lays out some of those complexities a little better and makes people sort of see how Catholicism has become part of discussions about politics and discussion about art and discussions about literature and, you know, and so on.
Yeah, and at a very basic level, I would also just add in response to that question that for us, American Catholicism, we want to make it clear that Catholicism is not static or monolithic. That yes, absolutely, there is some universality to the story, and that's what makes the sort of the American Catholic experience notable, that it's part of a global community. But it's also shaped by its own time and circumstances, and the internal diversity of American Catholicism needs to be recognized and appreciated more fully. And its internal diversity, not just in terms of different ethnic and racial groups, but also the diversity of time and place. And sort of the book that Maggie was talking about by Pfeiffer that looks at regional cultures to reinforce that kind of Catholicism in the Northeast is not the same in the Southwest or, you know, other regions of the country. Or chronologically, that the Catholic Church that Mother Seton knew in the early Republic is not the same Catholic Church of the immigrant era with its dense institutional networks in terms of schools and hospitals and parishes and everything like that. She was operating in a very different social and ecclesiastical context.
Those are good perspectives because, you know, the regional aspect and just tying it into the greater study really helps you know, the individuals who aren't familiar with the church. Now, in terms of, you know, researchers, students, and so forth, what advice would you give to budding scholars, being experts in the fields yourself, in the field yourselves, in terms of looking forward, in terms of building upon the work you've done with this particular volume, but also in terms of their own interest within Catholic-based scholarship?
Yeah, sort of, I was thinking about this a little bit, and I think one thing, while we have lots of advice to our fellow scholars of American Catholicism, often that's preaching to the choir. And I think the harder challenge is getting scholars who might not think about American Catholicism to recognize the importance of the American Catholic story to their areas of research. And so American Catholicism to thinking about the history of things like American political life, social movements, social activism, how Catholics have played an outside role in that history. Or people today who may think of the Catholic Church in terms of, sort of perhaps repressive, to think about the way that Catholicism offered opportunity to generations. And for Maggie and I, whose works our research on women religious, you know, sort of Catholic sisters were some of the best educated and in some ways perhaps counterintuitively most liberated women during the 19th and early 20th century, because sisterhood provided opportunity and resources and the potential for collective action in a way that other American women lacked. That the Catholic sisters were CEOs of hospitals, presidents of colleges and universities. They were deeply involved in their local communities. And so those are the types of stories we want sort of scholars outside of American Catholicism to recognize the importance of the Catholic story to their work.
Yeah, I would agree. And, you know, it always amazes me that histories of education are written without mentioning nuns. You know, I don't understand how you can leave that, the parochial school system, out of that picture and the women religious who staffed them. But I was heartened. I sat on a dissertation defense from University College in Dublin on Monday, and the topic was, this woman has looked at how the Presentation Sisters in Ireland financed their convents, which is a real piece of economic history, you know, that we haven't really looked at. And really, Alan, you mentioned archives earlier, really did amazing work digging through archives to find all these account books and receipts and stories and letters. But to kind of write about things that bring the story of Catholicism, as Tom said, into other areas.
It's so true, Maggie. And the good part is that, you know, individuals are still learning, and you're right in terms of this collaboration. It's really the historians who really put the words out there that really inspire and, you know, individuals go forward. Now, my last question is basically, in terms of the feedback you've been receiving, you know, the book coming out last year, do you have any final thoughts on this particular work? And I know you've maybe mentioned it before, but just any final thoughts that you want to additionally share with our audience?
I would just say, and we haven't gotten a whole lot of feedback yet, but I would just say that one thing, and we talk about this in the introduction of the book, and it was a deliberate choice not to have an essay on the issue of sexual abuse in the Catholic Church. And also there's, and that was because it is unfolding. And people are just writing about that now and just looking at that now. And the same with, which wasn't even on the radar when we began this, issues of boarding schools for Indigenous people, which again are just, we weren't even thinking about that when the book started. And so I guess I would just say, you know, it's never, history's never finished. You know, there are going to be more essays that will be needed. And so it's as complete as we could have made it, but yet it's not complete, you know, in the end.
And I would just sort of say for all of our Seton Hall listeners, you can check out the volume by going to the university's library homepage and searching for the Cambridge Companion to American Catholicism. It'll take you to the Cambridge core. You can look at the book as a whole, but you can download individual chapters that may catch your eye. And so Maggie and I are deeply appreciative of the work that the authors did, and we're very proud of being able to feature their work and bring it together in one volume.
Great. Thank you both. Thanks for the plug, Tom. I really appreciate that. Oh, and I was quick. I have just one last question. For individuals who'd like to provide feedback and for answering any questions, can you follow up with your contact information for our audience?
Sure. Well, sort of for the Seton Hall listeners, please visit the Seton Hall University's History Department webpage, and you can find my contact information there. The wonders of sort of a quick Google search for that. If you just search our names, you can find our institutional email addresses.
Right, same, go to LaSalle's webpage for the religion department and there's my information. And we'd be happy to hear what people think.
This is wonderful, Maggie and Tom. Thank you both very much. And as you say, Maggie, history is never ending and it keeps going forward. And we're thankful about that. And we're also thankful for your time here today. This was a very enjoyable discussion, so I thank you for your time. Now, for more information on the book, The Cambridge Companion of American Catholicism, published by Cambridge University Press, I can be reached myself via email at alan.delozier@shu.edu. Delozier is D-E-L-O-Z-I-E-R. And once again, a sincere thank you to Dr. Margaret McGinnis and Dr. Tom Resnick for joining us, and thanks to you for listening to Zet Forward. Please join us next time when we talk to other individuals from the Seton Hall community about their work and how it benefits the world around us. Until we meet again, all the best and thank you.